Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. There is a very beautiful tradition in Judaism that few outside of the religion know about. It's called Midrash. There are a couple of different kinds of Midrash, but what I'm thinking about is when a story from the Bible is explored and often a narrative is created to fill in the gaps of what the scripture neglects to tell us. It's a wonderful way to bridge the ancient with the contemporary. Well, the book we're discussing today very well could be termed Buddhist Midrash. It's called Bride of the Buddha. Many of you are familiar with the story of Siddhartha, the one who would become known in history as the Buddha, and how he renounced all his worldly comforts, plus a wife and son, to become a wandering monk seeking enlightenment. In this account, the wife he left plays a hapless minor role. But as you can tell from the title of this book, here she moves much closer to center stage. Keep in mind that this is a novel filled with much conjecture, but aside from a very compelling story, it works as a Mahayana, or great vehicle, for learning the basic history and concepts of Buddhism. I'm very excited to recommend this excellent read, and today we'll speak with its author, Dr. Barbara McHugh. Some things you might want to know about Dr. McHugh. She is a published poet with many years of professional experience editing fiction, newsletters, and technical documents. Her degrees are from New York University, the University of California at Berkeley, and the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Barbara has been studying Buddhism and practicing meditation for decades. She has taught many introductory courses on both topics and co-leads an ongoing sitting group in Berkeley. She is on the board of directors of Marin Sangha. So we welcome to Common Threads Barbara McHugh. Hello, Barbara.
Hi.
So wonderful to have you here, and I really did enjoy the book. You know, we don't cover a lot of fiction on this show. Most of what we talk about is, nonfiction, obviously. If we don't talk about fiction, really, how many choices do you have? When I heard about this book, I thought, no, this needs a reading. And so here we are. I wanted to ask you, so you are a practicing Buddhist. I wanted to find out which branch. And I'm going to take a stab before you answer. And I'm thinking you might be Theravada, but if I'm wrong, tell me why.
Absolutely, yes. That's most of my research I did for this book was from the Pali Canon, the oldest scriptures of the Buddha. And I practiced in the Theravada tradition. I've done a few Zen retreats. I've read into the other Mahayana Buddhist traditions and done a few exercises. But my main practice definitely is the Theravada. But I also belong to a progressive Christian church.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
What denomination?
UCC.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's just something that has become more and more important. Although I have a friend who calls herself a non-theist Christian. And I thought, yes, I could call myself that. Then I say, I could also call myself a non-theist theist, because sometimes I find theism opens the knowledge of my heart in a completely unintellectual way that helps me work on myself, or rather diminish the tyranny of the self that the Buddha talks about when he talks about ending suffering.
I think you've got your next book ready to go.
It's a hobby horse I've been riding lately. The importance of the complementary nature of Buddhism and Christianity.
Sure, I understand that, and we have covered that on this show more than once.
Better.
So tell me, what inspired this book, Bride of Buddha, for you?
Well, the real, I think, inspiration came because so many women I knew were turned off to Buddhism because its founder had abandoned his wife and child. And I wanted to explore that story, and I also was turned off when I first heard it. I thought, you know, what is this? And I wanted to explore the story. I wanted to see what the Buddha's motivations could be. Is it necessary for the myth? And so probably most of your readers know the basic myth of Buddhism, where the Buddha's father wanted a king and not a holy man as a son. And his son, a prophet, told him that his son would either be a world-turning monarch or a great holy man. So the father said, well, you know, he was going to make sure that the world-turning monarch was going to be the thing his son would turn out to be. So he protected his son from all signs of sickness and death and set him up in beautiful palaces and gave him sort of a perfect life. Well, this is a myth. I mean, the actual historical Buddha, as far as people can tell, was the son of a clan leader in northern India in a clan oligarchical republic. But anyway, the ideal life was the prince in the palace, no signs of sickness and death, and then he marries a beautiful princess and has a son, which is the greatest thing you could do in a patriarchy. And then, at age 29, he sees a sick man, an old man, a corpse, and a holy man, and the sight of the first three is devastating to him because this the symbolic existential angst arises. Suddenly, his life becomes meaningless in the face that it's going to end, and everything he loves is going to die, and he needs to become a holy man to find out the answers. And the holy man is there to inspire him, the presence of that holy man. Sometimes those four sick man, old man, corpse, and holy man are considered the four heavenly messengers because they prompt the Buddha to go out on his journey of enlightenment. Now, the question being, well, why does he have to leave? Why does there have to be a wife and a two-day-old baby that he deserts for this myth to work? And they're taken care of by his family. He doesn't leave them by the side of the road or anything. But still, you know, I mean, as a woman who's been dumped several times in her life, thankfully not without. Thankfully, with no children involved, I wanted to know what was going on from her point of view. But in terms of the importance of the myth, I think he needed to leave the perfect life. The myth would not have been as powerful had he just been some wastrel who'd been hanging out in the palaces and enjoying himself and, you know, finally the last hangover he gets tired of and decides to become a holy man. No, he has to leave the perfect life because one of the things the Buddha teaches, the primary thing, is that all life entails suffering. All life will end. And this is what he set about to solve.
I'm curious.
But meanwhile, there's the voice that is lost, which is that of the Buddha's wife. So that's what sort of got me going with the story.
I'm curious, Barbara. This story that anybody who's taken a world religions class, they have heard or they have read about the abandonment of his family, about living a supposedly perfect life away from suffering, and then all of a sudden he gets a jolt by seeing these things that you mention. Is that something that is believed by some Buddhists? I mean, are there so-called fundamentalist Buddhists who accept this as true history? Or would you say in the Buddhist world, people agree with you that it is a myth or an allegory?
I think most Buddhists at this point see it as a myth, but there are fundamentalist Buddhists. I have met a few. And, you know, or they almost take the story literally anyway. I mean, they don't really cling to it, but they just assume he was a prince in a palace. But when you reflect on the difficulty of not ever witnessing sickness or death or old age for 29 years of your life, I mean, it's absurd.
Exactly.
I think most people see the mythical part of that.
Certainly.
But they still, some people then do resent the fact that the wife was abandoned. But as I said, I think that's important because part of the ideal life is a mature love and a love for a child. And I remember reading once about a man who was in some other religious tradition, probably some Judeo-Christian tradition. And he was saying, well, the poor Buddha, he must never have known the touch of a child or the love in a woman's eyes. And well, no, he did know them. That's the whole point. When he really began to see the passing away of all reality and death, he had to find something more.
Tell us about the research that was involved in writing this book. From what I understand, you delved quite heavily into the Pali Canon. Tell us about the research and what you learned before you actually put pen to paper.
Okay, well, I have to say my own practice, too, was research. Because the meditation and the experiences, I had to come from all my solitary and residential retreats and my own meditation, my own struggles. So that in itself was research. The Pali Canon was the oldest body of Buddhist scripture. I think I mentioned that. It was orally transmitted after around 483 BC, which is the kind of traditional date of of the Buddha's death. A lot of people now are saying it came a little bit later. But anyway, they were not written down until the first century BC. And what I did was, many of the stories in my novel are from, or the episodes in my novel, are from those stories in the canon. And I also took a two-year course in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is one of the canon's main compilations of suttas. And I've dipped into a lot of other canons. And then I've read scholarly commentaries and histories of the time. This was never part of my formal education, though. But I read a lot of Richard Gombrich and Bhikkhu Bodhi and Stephen Batchelor and Karen Armstrong and a lot, and did a retreat run by the Venerable Anilayo, who is an amazing scholar and probably the closest thing to an enlightened monk I've experienced, just because of his work schedule is inhuman. He's either writing copiously or meditating. When we were on retreat, we would all leave, because you retreat, you meditate for 45 minutes, and you go walk for 45 minutes, then you go back, and you do this all morning, then you go to lunch, and then you do the same thing. We'd come back, and he'd be sitting there meditating, having not moved all day. So he was a remarkable resource. And anyway, they discuss the idea that the Buddha is not a prince in a palace, and the background times when he lived in this axial period from around 800 to 200 BC, where it seemed like in India, the Mediterranean, and China, and I'm sure your shows have raised that topic before, things were sort of up for grabs. Life was no longer comfortable. There was a kind of self-consciousness that impelled the people to go on holy quests and impelled the prophets to say, my God, where are you? And so there's all this stuff going on during the Buddha's time. And so I did read a little bit into that, too. I also traveled in India and in the 70s, and this was before I was doing formal research in the book. I stayed in ashrams, and I walked around northern India a lot. And I planned in 2016 to do a tour of all the Buddhist sites. And I was right in the middle of writing the book, and this was going to be great. But unfortunately, my husband was hospitalized a week before, so I never did get a chance to do that. So I spent my time looking up pictures of the Buddhist sites on the Internet. And I already had a sense of the climate of India and the people and the spirit. It is unique. My husband has also traveled with me on other trips, and he always says, most of the time when you go on vacation, it takes a while to, you know, sort of decompress from your work life and your life back home. You go to India, and you are just in it right away. You are in another world. It's just there. It is just a whole different spirit, and holy people are still walking on the roads and talking about God, and...
No,
it's just an amazing place.
Yes. My wife and I have experienced that, and it's a perfect training ground for surrender, isn't it? When you go to India, you have to surrender to the process. No expectations.
Yes, I remember one time, because I was telling myself, I am going to, this is before I became a Buddhist, I am going to learn patience. But I was still interested in, the Vedanta tradition and all, the whole Eastern tradition. And I remember standing in line trying to get a ticket for a railroad ticket. I stood in line. People would come barging in front of me. And I finally got to the window after about an hour, and the window closes. I did not learn patience. What I think I did learn in India was to take myself less seriously. I had some rather harrowing adventures.
Yeah.
I ended up being carried out of the mountains in a basket with hepatitis.
Oh,
I had to pay somebody $50. And I had to ask myself the question, how much is my life worth? Because someone said, well, you have to be carried out. I couldn't walk at this point. I was so weak. And they said, a helicopter will cost $500. This is back in the 70s, and I thought, is my life worth $500 at this point? I don't think I quite even have $500 to my name. So I thought, nah, it's not worth $500. I'll take the basket. And so I did.
What you should have learned in India was how to say "no cuts, buddy" in Hindi, but. let's move on from there.
We should know it.
I want to remind folks, if you're just tuning in, that you're listening to WGVU's Common Threads. My name is Fred Stella, and Dr. Barbara McHugh is my guest. She is the author of Bride of Buddha. So I'm just going to shotgun some of my observations and questions from actually reading the book. One surprise was that at the time of the Buddha, at least the earlier part of his life, there was no cremation. You had grounds for corpses to be consumed by animals. I know that the Zoroastrians do that to this day, but I was not aware that at the time, but it would be before Hindu, it would be before Buddhism, so they would be Hindus, I guess. They would just leave bodies at grounds. Do you know anything about how cremation overtook that? Because they didn't bury them; they just left them there.
Yeah. I'm not. There still are cremation charnel grounds in some places, but the charnel ground contemplations were very important to the early Buddhists. To go sit in the charnel ground, and it was terrifying to them. And so monks would go and sit all night in a charnel ground, and this was done. But the Buddha himself was cremated, so I couldn't find the information. I'm sure it's out there. What exactly changed, or why the charnel grounds weren't as universally used, but they certainly were used at first.
And is it true that at the time of the Buddha, I believe this would be before he actually achieved enlightenment, that there were wandering sadhus, holy men, but there were no women who did that, who took up that kind of life?
There were some women. Again, the information I found was scant. There were some women who did it. I felt an odd kind of paradox, because this was a time, relatively affluent period, where there was a lot of travel, a lot of trade, and I think, and this is one explanation for the axial age, that, people couldn't just turn on their own, rely on their built-in gods anymore, because there was somebody else with other kinds of gods and other beliefs, and all this mixing made people more self-conscious and more doubtful. Don't know for sure. But wait, what was the question again?
Women taking up the life of wandering.
Oh, yes, women. Yes, there were. In fact, there were whole families that would sometimes go out and go forth into homelessness. And it was a respected thing to do. I mean, people would take them in and give them money. This was considered heroic back then, to do this. But if you were a king and you wanted your son to be a Or if you were a clan leader, you wanted your son to be in the family tradition. You didn't want him to leave household life.
Sure. So how much is written about the Buddha's wife? Her name, by the way, is, it can be pronounced Yashodhara or Yasodhara. Which one do you prefer?
I usually just pronounce it Yasodhara. I call her Yasi.
Yasi, okay. What do we know about her? Because obviously, I'm sure there's a Gordian knot of allegory, myth, and history all tied together. What can we assume?
Well, very, very little. In the Kali canon, the Pali canon, she's hardly mentioned at all. In fact, she's never mentioned by the name Yasodhara. She's mentioned simply as a word for meaning Rahula's mother. So she's, and the last time we hear about her is when she gives her son over to be a monk, she just says, this is your father, go take your inheritance, which could be interpreted as a rather bitter, sullen thing to do. Karen Armstrong believes that, she just dropped out, okay, take your son and forget it. But we don't know. It's very formal. But meanwhile, after the Pali Canon, in the Mahayana tradition and other traditions, there are all sorts of all sorts of myths and stories and legends about her, that she joined the Sangha, she became enlightened. And I mention this in the novel, and I have Yasi sort of write them off as rumor or gossip. And she even mentioned the rumor that supposedly she had been pregnant for the entire 6 years that that Siddhartha had been gone, becoming enlightened, and she didn't give birth until he came back. And she said, "Thank God that rumor wasn't true." But one of the reasons why, and that was nice for me in that, oh hooray, I had sort of a blank slate to work with. On the other hand, oh dear, what was I going to write about? And this is where the gender switch thing came in.
Yeah, what I find interesting throughout the book is that several times, and this book is written from the point of view of Yasi, and she will say such and such a thing supposedly happened, and people spread that gossip. But it isn't true. And I would assume that every time I read that there is a story that has gone around for several centuries about her or about the Buddha. And you, the author, are saying, but that don't take that literally, or this could be nonsense.
Right, I don't have any gratuitous stories about her that she had, but I wanted to, cover my bases and, set it up as close to what the stories about her are and how I could deal with them.
Sure. At the beginning of chapter 3, when you talk about their lives in the Shankyan clan, it sounds like they lived a rather bacchanalian existence. Is that true? Yeah, just a lot of courtesans and easy living and almost hedonistic. Am I reading that correctly?
They were more thorough. I was trying to convey the sort of they lived. There were a lot of ceremonies, for gods, and they're very celebratory. And if you go to particularly Nepal, I noticed this. At least before all of the troubles they've had, I haven't been back in, I haven't been in Nepal since the early aughts, but there's always a celebration, there's a celebration of the brother god and Durga, and, there are all these celebrations, and everyone enjoys them, and there's this communal, in the ancient world in general, there was so much more of these communal celebrations, and that was more I was getting, it wasn't so much they were all having orgies and But there certainly were concubines, although I think in the Buddhist clan, I tried to sort of say that it was more like there were women's quarters, and the cousins and the wives lived together. But I wasn't trying to convey a bacchanalian sense in the sense that it's like ancient Rome or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Why was it that there was this separation, these women's quarters that you talk about? What were they trying to encourage?
Well, I've tried to keep women down, you know, I mean, control them. I think that during this so-called, this is just what I'm thinking of now, but during this so-called axial age, where people were becoming very aware of death and sickness, I think women might very well have become more frightening. You know, because women are bloody and leaky, and you know they're too close to life and death. And let's just put them in the women's quarters and take them out when we need them.
But it isn't. For like the clan leader, there wasn't a harem, so to speak.
There was. It's unclear whether the Buddhist family had harems. It was something, the Buddhist clan was sort of an outlier. They were on the edge of things. And so they supposedly didn't have a caste system, although they surely had a class system. But a formal harem, if they did, it would be like one or two extra wives. It wouldn't be a big harem. Now, harems became much more, as the years went by, harems, I think, became more common and more accepted. When there were monarchs and, you know, powerful kings would have harems. So it wasn't, there was a lot of contradictory information about how much of a harem there were. Some people, there are writings about, oh, the Buddha had a second wife, and I actually talk about that as one of the rumors too.
Right. Barbara, we are out of time for this episode, but this is a great conversation, and we would love to have you back next week if you can. You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today has been Dr. Barbara McHugh, and she is the author of Bride of the Buddha. Please join us again next week here on WGVU-FM.